Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And before we jump into today's show, in case you haven't heard, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show has been added to the iHeartRadio network, so you can find us there, as well as TuneIn, iTunes, and here on Blog Talk Radio. So today, my very special guest is Polo Tate, and we will be talking about her book, Deep Dark Blue, A Memoir of Survival. I want to be in the Air Force someday. These are the words that Polo Tate engraved on her junior dog tags at age 11. It was an unpopular dream for most young girls, but her hard work paid off. And at age 18, Polo started basic training at the United States Air Force Academy. She did everything right, from academics to athletics. But no one prepared her for what came next: physical, sexual, and emotional abuse at the hands of her superiors, harassment from her peers who refused to believe her story. Deep Dark Blue is more than a memoir about sexual assault. It's about breaking boundaries, but also setting them. It's about learning to trust your instincts. It's a story of survival, resilience, and finally, finding your joy. Polo lives in New York City, is an actor and performer at such places as Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the Broadway Comedy Club, Reckless, and The Pit. And Deep Dark Blue is her debut memoir. You can find her book at Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link in the show page description to her book there. You can also find out more about Polo by visiting her website, which is polotate.com. That's P-O-L-O-T-A-T-E.com. And I also have a link to her website in the show page description as well. So with that, I'd like to welcome Polo to the show. Good day, Polo.
Good day. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And boy, our topic today can't be more timely with everything that's in the news.
Sadly true.
Very, yeah, sadly as well. You're correct on that. I guess the best place to start would be, what inspired you to write this particular book?
Well, my original inspiration was, I guess, most primal. It was sheer survival. I was in my own tormented trauma of trying to deal with all that had happened at the United States Air Force Academy at USAFA. And my first line of defense at the time was not to talk about it, but it was to write about it. The analytical side of my brain could finally sort of be a release valve of catharsis for my wounded, obliterated heart. And so I wrote, and I dumped everything that had happened out onto paper, everything that I felt about it. So my original inspiration was to just get it out of me, that toxicity. And then I sought to get it published so that I could offer some sort of comfort and companionship and catharsis to those who are trapped in their own solitary confinement of circumstance, and to be able to help at least one other person.
Yeah. It seems that just the act of writing it down, and journaling experiences is very cathartic for, people who, are subject to trauma like you. And it seems like even if it doesn't get to the point of publication, it does seem to have that healing effect in a way.
It is so true. And in this culture of, as we become more enlightened and more willing to talk about things that are soul nourishing and self edifying, it may seem trite to talk about journaling, but I'm telling you, it is essential to get it out in whatever, by any means necessary, whether it's screaming into a void, whether it's talking to a professional, whether it's boxing classes, whatever your particular mode is, to get out whatever is eating at you or whatever you're struggling with. It is just, it's essential.
Yeah, very much. So, this is obviously a very personal story. So did you have any reservations about putting it out there?
Yes. Yes, I did. Of course I did. And for all the reasons that we are seeing right now, with Christine Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh, with Cosby and his accusers. When you come forward to speak your own truth out loud, you inevitably open yourself up to the court of public opinion. And our culture has historically had a hard time with having this particular difficult conversation. It's a hard thing to talk about. But guess what? It's even harder to experience, to survive,
yeah,
and to live with.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's you're right. I mean, we're seeing this, played out on, right now. And to me, it's just incredible the negativity, thrown at someone who experiences abuse. To me, it's just like redoing or kind of, accentuating the negativity and just really not given an opportunity to be heard, understood, having some empathy, for what someone has gone through.
It's so true. And it explains everything about why victims and survivors wait to come forward, if at all, because of that fear and of that, no matter who the court of public opinion is, whether it be a confidant and a friend, whether it be your family, whether it be in the media playing out as we see it now, that's an incredibly vulnerable position in which we put ourselves. And for the longest time, after something horrific has happened, after we've suffered a trauma, we keep silent, thinking that the actual revelation to another party is what blows up people's lives and ruins reputations and disrupts the everyday life. But in actuality, it's the trauma itself. The very choice that those attackers made to brutalize me was the actual event, not me disclosing it. And for the longest time, I thought me disclosing it was the trauma, because that made it real, because that opened it up for perhaps my cadre and superiors to pursue it further in terms of an investigation. I took that responsibility on myself, as do many survivors of such an attack, when in actuality, it's not our fault. It is not that which we brought upon ourselves. It's not our entire responsibility. What we do with that and how we choose to transcend it and overcome it, absolutely our responsibility. We have power in our own lives, and that's, of course, paramount.
Also part of the disclosure, it also can possibly serve as a deterrent from the attacker continuing the pattern. When you look at the Cosby, aspect, that went over decades, makes you wonder if there were some disclosures. And again, like you say, it's difficult, and it's you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position, but the fact that if you can disclose it, there's a chance that the pattern can be interrupted.
Yes, very true. Very true, and it takes incredibly brave and courageous women and men to come forward with that information.
Absolutely. So now, in your book, you discuss abuse twice, once by a female and one a male. So can you kind of briefly describe, you know, those experiences?
Yes, the first assault happened about midway through my freshman year, which is at the Air Force Academy. It's called your 4-degree year. And it happened with the captain of my volleyball team. She had taken me under her wing. She had paid me special attention. She was a senior at the time, which we call a firstie. And I thought that it had mirrored a relationship that I had in high school where the best athlete of our region, of our state, took me under her wing, sort of the best, bringing up the next potential best in terms of athletic prowess. And so I was excited initially. I was eager to get better and to become friends with a firstie. And little did I know that she had led me under a sort of seduction of sorts to isolate me, to make sure that she was in a prime position so that her power could not be disputed. And one night when we were at our coach's house, I woke up to her on top of me, overpowering me, clawing at my skin. And the whole incident, God, it just broke me, almost. It broke me. And about 3 weeks later, claiming he had known about volleyball team secrets and that I needed to keep my mouth shut, there was a C3C K-bar, as I refer to him in the book, a 3-degree who had come into my room, locked the door, knocked me off my feet, and brutally attacked me and forced himself on me. Both attacks were violent, brutal, physically penetrating, emotionally eviscerating. It was awful.
That is, it is. I mean, it's just, you know, to me, it's just amazing how some people can you know, survive and then thrive afterwards, you know, after such a awful experience. I mean, very violating experience. Now, I also understand that you experienced some harassment from peers, maybe who didn't believe in that. Can you tell me how, or tell us how that unfolded, or what that experience was like?
I think it's important to note in the USAFA culture, we are training to be soldiers. We are training to lay down our life for the person next to us, to lead troops that defend and protect our nation. And it was no accident that I was appointed to the Air Force Academy. It was no accident that I got a senatorial nomination and that I had worked since age 11 doing double-day practices, NHS, 4.0 GPA, you know, all of those things that driven highly charged individuals do in pursuit of their goal, in pursuit of their dream. And it is that mentality that makes it even more difficult to come forward and disclose vulnerability in such a cellular level in a situation like this. So my first instinct was to clam up, was to not say a word, was to yank myself up by my bootstraps and move on. And so when when a teammate of mine finally came into my room because I was not functioning, because I was disassociating in a PTSD, just wreck. She finally elicited the information from me about the first attack. I told her about the first attack. And so as that process ensued, you know, immediately it was out of my hands. It was in the hands of my chain of command. My peers, of course, caught wind of it. And there is not much that stays quiet, I guess, with the scuttlebutt at the Air Force Academy. And scuttlebutt, of course, military parlance for gossip. So as even if they didn't have the details of the of exactly what had happened, they knew something happened. They knew I wasn't functioning as a cadet, and now there was an investigation that started. So it of course put a target on my back in terms of what, in a high performance environment, when one of your team members is not performing, then you either do everything that it takes to get them in line or you cut them loose. And a lot of times that's taken to mean chastising, hazing, threats, castigation, all of those things in trying to set their course straight. And all of those things, of course, happened.
Wow. When you have cases like that, did you, with your academy mates, were there any kind of gender distinctions as to, you know, the, I mean, like, were women more understanding than men, or is it just an individual kind of thing that, you know, depending on the person, whether, you know, they believed you and kind of helped you along, or whether they were in that hazing, castizing kind of environment. I mean, you know, how was there any gender differences, you know, as to how people responded to you once it, you know, the scuttlebutt was out?
This is such a good question, and it really speaks sort of to the heart of what broke my heart about the Air Force Academy when I got there. And listen, I had played on all-male teams my entire life. I had pitched on all-male baseball team, played in all-male soccer leagues. You know, I was not a stranger to widely male, if not all-male environments, and I love men. I'm so,
right.
That's what was one of the things that was so enticing was the Air Force Academy, the Air Force, the military in general was the ultimate team. And when I got there and when everything started happening, and even before that, just in basic training and some of the verbal darts that are thrown at you, they were widely gendered, with women often being at the expense. You run like a girl. My grandmother can do pushups like a girl. You're a sissy like a girl. Whatever those things are that are thrown at you, it's a highly, and it's a holdover from, you know, centuries past of that. And so the first assault, being female on female, of course, added this strange pallor to the whole thing. And what was saddest about the Air Force Academy to me was women being so heavily outnumbered. We were 11% at the time. Instead of banding together in support of one another, or just men and women, my classmates, banding together in support of someone, instead it was sort of every man out for themselves. And I'm making generalizations here because I had a few buoys at the Air Force Academy who were brilliant and amazing. But the vast majority, we still have a lot of room to go in terms of taking the gender out of the equation in terms of that being a liability, and really understanding our differences and using them in such a way so that we can work together and make the most of that environment. And we have a long way to go. And my experience was definitely, definitely proof of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it really gets back to the the crux of the motivation being, you know, power, trying to, you know, overpower and exhibit power is really one of the key motivations for, you know, abusive situations. And, you know, that's the one thing that I'm...
You're exactly right. It is not about gender. It is about power. It's not about sex. It's about power. It's about violence. It's about hurt people hurting people. You're exactly right.
Yeah. So now, what is the U.S. Air Force Academy's process for handling, you know, that kind of abuse?
Well, it has improved a bit from when I was there.
Okay.
I say that tentatively because I know that we still have a long way to go. And the most important, and like we just talked about, the most important process is the reporting process itself. It's feeling safe enough to weigh the threats and the hazing and the castigation against what you feel you want to do and what you know is right in coming forward. It's having a safe enough space for that to outweigh so that victims do feel comfortable coming forward and seeking help. And that comes before anything. That comes before one single word of it is spoken to another person. So it depends on the situation. And obviously, unlike the civilian world, the military, including the service academies, must adhere to the UCMJ, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, when dealing with criminal matters. So there's an extra layer of law that they need to adhere to. So when one is broken, there is usually an IG investigation, which is an Inspector General investigation, which commenced for the first assault once my chain of command was notified. And I know... I had watched, it's so interesting we're talking about this right now, because in December of last year, I watched with the nation as the new superintendent of USAFA, Lieutenant General Silvera, sat on national television and said verbatim that we do not have a problem with sexual assault at the Air Force Academy. And I nearly fell off my chair because, of course, we know better now. Now, he may not have meant what it's how it came off. And I don't think that he is a bad man. I think he's trying to do the best that he can, but we can't keep denying its existence. We can't keep denying that sexual violence pervades and it pervades the military. It's a human issue, and USAFA, as well as the entire military, are having a problem with it for the last, decades upon decades. We've seen it in so many hierarchical structures now, with Hollywood and Cosby just now, and Weinstein, with Kavanaugh and Trump even, the Catholic Church, college campuses. We've seen this in so many hierarchical structures where sexual violence pervades. But the difference is when it pervades our military, it compromises our national security. Because if I'm worried about the soldier on my left and I'm scared of the soldier on my right, then I'm not thinking about the greater mission at hand. I'm not thinking about doing my job, which is to protect our beautiful country. So I think the silver lining here is that USAFA is a highly controlled environment. And they, I believe in their potential to really be leaders of change in this. And I challenge them. I pose this challenge to the Air Force Academy, let's say that, this bastion of higher learning that incubates tomorrow's leaders today. And I say this with love because I believe in them. I challenge them to live up to their mission statement. I challenge them to be the change this country so desperately needs right now. I challenge them to call upon what they're good at, their superpowers, and create a self-sustaining, progressive environment based on trust and respect in which sexual violence of this kind and sexual assault simply cannot exist. That's my challenge for the Air Force Academy, to be the leading edge of change that takes us out of the problem of sexual violence and into a solution. They're a controlled enough environment where I really do believe that they have the potential to do that, to lead us.
Yeah, you know, and the fact that it is a controlled environment and very big on structure does it does make it easier for them in many ways to be able to create that model, you know, that can be then exported, you know, to the civilian environment. So now you mentioned that, you know, things are a little bit better now than they were when you were there. So can you talk about maybe some of the progress, you know, what is better? And then beyond that, what would even be better yet, you know, that still needs a bit more attention?
I think the fact that you and I are having this conversation right now, I think is huge. And I think the country waking up, of course, with all the movements that are going on right now is huge. And I know that because of what I just talked about in terms of Lieutenant General Silvera going on national television saying that, because of that, as a result of that, they've now changed and modified their how they handle sexual assault so that if there is an infraction that happens around during the course of a sexual assault, sexual violence or brutality in some way, and an investigation has commenced, then the punishment, I guess, is lessened for the victim and the friends involved in terms of any rules that they may have broken, academy rules, or if they had gone off campus and they shouldn't have been. The circumstances surrounding the sexual assault itself are taken into consideration when somebody comes forward. So that, for the Air Force Academy, that's a big step. And it's commendable. It is not nearly as far as we need to go. And I think it's important for, we've had enough people come forward now. It is really important for survivors to work with administration at the Air Force Academy to really put together a solid curriculum, to really put together a framework that cadets are mandated to go through, but more so is absorbed in the culture, in the fine nitty-gritty language and expression of culture at the Air Force Academy, in the military in general, that really represents the progress that we've made in this country to date. So I think it's important that first and foremost, that administration is not at odds with its cadets, but rather works in conjunction with them and in conjunction with those who have come forward to really make change.
Yeah, okay. Well, great. Well, we're about halfway through the show, so I do want to take just a real quick break, and it looks like we have a caller who wants to chat for a second. So when we come back from the break, we will chat with him, and then I want to start talking a bit about your journey after the experiences and the healing path that you took, okay?
Great.
Okay, everyone, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello. This is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
everyone. Thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest is Polo Tate, and we are talking about her new book, Deep Dark Blue, A Memoir of Survival. Again, her book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link in the show page description to her book there, as well as you can find out more by visiting her website, which is polotate.com, and that's polotate.com. Again, there is a direct link to that as well in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Polo.
Thank you.
Great.
Good to be back.
And now, great, thanks. And before I bring on the caller, I have to say that the first couple chapters of your book, when your superiors were yelling orders at you that were all caps, I felt that pain. I mean, I felt like I was right there, you know. Luckily, I wasn't. But you know, you really did a great job of conveying the atmosphere that you were in.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I feel like I should apologize for having you have the weather-based training.
Well, because it was on tape, because it was on paper and not in person, you know, that abuse wasn't there. But I read a lot of books, and I really felt that you did a really great job of presenting that and really, you know, taking the reader along with you on that journey. So it was just well done. Mm. I just wanted to make sure to say that.
Thank you.
You're
truly
welcome.
From the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, we do have a caller. His name is Bob. He's calling from the Whitsunday Islands off the coast of Australia. So good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Robert, and good morning, Polo. And,
good morning, Bob.
Well done. And, yeah, it's 6:30 in the morning here. And, I just want to thank you. It's good day, mate, as we say in Australia.
There you go.
I just want to honour your courage in speaking your truth. And quickly just share what's present for me, because I've been through a similar experience. And for me, where I'm 66 now, and I'm master and commander of my life. My life is awesome. But in my own journey to get there, I believe that we're all victims of victims, and people that abuse other people are just acting out the abuse that they went through in their childhood. And like in my own healing journey, I was doing the inner child work. I got to this space where I hated my mum because she was always beating me. You know, but you've got to love your mum because you only got one mum. And it was that dichotomy that was tearing me apart. And so I came across this phrase, if you don't hand it back, you pass it on. So I wrote mum a letter saying, dear mum, this is me telling you my story of how it felt for me as a kid growing up in our family. And so I got the, you know, the pen and paper out, and I thought it was going to be a couple of pages, but it ended up like War and Peace, you know, like, I hated it when you beat me with this, and I hated it, but I got it all out. I got it all out, and I posted this tome back to mum in the UK, and that was the hardest thing I ever did. And I eventually got a letter back from mum saying, oh, Bobby, you must think I'm the first mother in the whole world, but I was only doing my best. And I wrote back saying, mum, this is not about blame. This is about telling you my story. Tell me yours. So mum wrote back. She was born in Germany, 24, between the wars. Her dad was an alcoholic. Her mum was a control freak. Her cousins were in the SS, or they were shot, you know. And so by her sharing her story, I could understand the way she treated me wasn't her natural, you know, loving human being. It was the crap that got dumped in her childhood. And so by writing that letter, I broke the generational cycle of abuse and handed it back. And I started suffering from depression in 84. and now I believe there is no such thing as mental illness. and I'll quickly get through this because this is your show and your time. But it took me, I was suffering from depression for about 10 years and I started dancing with it. And one day I would just, you know, because medications were just repeating themselves, you know, they worked for 2 months and then they exacerbated the symptoms. But I just sat down one day and I thought, well, where is this pain coming from, this pain of depression? You know? And it suddenly struck me that any loving, natural, heart-centered human being would feel pain having to live in such a corrupt and unhuman society. So that's where the pain was coming from. Once I realized that the pain I was feeling was a natural response, I threw the meds away, I went cold turkey. And now, that pain of depression, and I'm getting to my point, is that was my soul slapping me about the head, saying, you know, if you don't start living your truth, you know, I'm going to keep slapping you until you wake up. So I had to move out of the head space into the heart space. And you mentioned PTSD, and, you know, I'm going to go all sort of Buddha and guru here. but for me, PTSD for me is so understandable, because if you turn your mind off and think of yourself living in the jungle, living in nature, living in harmony with all of life, then the greatest sin any human being can carry out is to take the life of another human being. So having to do that, or having to witness that, creates such a soul pain. And yet, people do it because they have been brainwashed and conditioned to believe that it is honorable to go out there and do that. Now, you know, and that for me is such a way to explain it. And, yeah, oh, God, I'm in tears now. We've got to stop killing each other and, you know, and get back to working together. You know, there are no boundaries. You look at the picture of the earth, and there's no boundaries there. This is, we've got one home. Let's live together. So I hope that makes sense, and thank you for allowing me the time. And what you're doing and what we're all doing is waking up to the humanness within us, Annie.
Mm. Bob, I have to tell you that I think you just described the most beautiful part of our human experience when you described your journey in finding out where your pain came from, in having the courage and the incredible, incredible bravery to reach out to your mom and ask where her pain came from, and for both of you being willing to listen to one another and have it land and have it resonate and have you make fundamental change because of it. That is true connection, and I cannot honor you enough, because I think so often we don't take the time to do that.
Well, Paolo, the funny thing is, after I got Mum's reply, I stopped crying. This was about a week later. I phoned Mum in the UK and she had a second incidence of bowel cancer. So I managed to get hold of her in St. John's Hospital in Newbury in Berkshire and spoke to her on the phone. And that was the first time we ever spoke as mother and son, adult to adult. And then 2 days later, she died. And so what a beautiful closure. And then
what a beautiful closure.
I'll just finish it off.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Hmm? Yeah, thanks, Robert. It is really quick. So I'm walking around like an elephant that's been taken off my shoulder. And I've spoken to Mum since she's passed on, and she is so thankful for me writing that letter, because it's allowed her to heal. But I'm walking around as if an elephant's been lifted off my shoulders, but there's still a little niggle there. And I thought, well, what's this niggle? Right, Dad, you bastard. So I got the notepad out and wrote a letter to Dad, but Dad was already dead, so I just wrote the letter, put it in an envelope to Dad in heaven, and burnt it. Once again, I handed it back so I wouldn't pass it on. So thank you, Paolo.
Brilliant.
And
thank you, Bob.
It's lovely to connect with you.
Lovely to connect with you.
Thank you, Bob. You know, what he was experiencing, experienced, you know, as far as that's your mom, you got to love your mom. You know, that was, it seems, you know, a similar kind of experience that you had with, you know, your female superior. I mean, in the sense that, you know, you have this, you feel as a connection, you know, that it should be naturally a very supportive and, positive kind of relationship, but then that is shattered when boundaries are crossed.
Agreed. And I think it circles back to what Bob so eloquently illustrated, and that is that the only person that we have responsibility, the only person that we can take responsibility for, that we can control, is ourselves. And if I, knowing what I know now in terms of boundaries, in terms of my own value, in terms of my own worthiness to be on this earth, to do what I love to do, to be surrounded by love and to be able to pursue my passion with ultimate purpose, had I really understood my vulnerabilities as I do now and accept them, I would have seen that coming in a way to be able to protect myself, because hurt people are the only ones that hurt people, and hurt and damaged people often use seduction and use those relationships and connections that you just spoke about to find a way in to be able to live out their own hurt and destructive pain. So it is so important to be utterly in touch with ourselves and to do the work, to go really inside and to do the work in our own lives so that we can be healthy and whole, so that we don't pass on what traumas have been done to us.
Exactly. And that cycle. So, you know, after those experiences, how would you describe your journey back, or, you know, or that healing path that you took after that point?
Well, given the personality that I described in terms of being driven and focused and goal-oriented, of course, once I finally graduated from college, and I ended up graduating from the University of Notre Dame, and my time there was not all sunshine and roses, for sure. I was fresh off having survived what I had survived at the Air Force Academy, and I definitely had my trials and tribulations while at Notre Dame. But I finally graduated, thank the Lord, and moved to New York City. And when I finally got to New York City, I truly started my journey, and it felt long at times. It felt arduous. It was scary, but there were moments of buoyancy that allowed me to keep afloat and pursuing what I really wanted to do, which was to act, forced me to get real introspective real quickly and real deeply, to get to know myself and all of those areas that we often don't explore, that we're afraid to explore, those corners of darkness that we must confront so that they don't weigh on us and so that we don't hurt other people with our pain. When I started studying improv, that too was hugely essential and life-changing in terms of really moving through my own journey of worthiness. And then, of course, writing the book, Deep Dark Blue, going through that catharsis of really facing what I had gone through so that I can finally leave that in the past, come to alignment within my own life, and live in an authentic and honest space forward moving and in the present moment, which is, of course, the beauty of what this life experience is about, is to be able to get to that point when you can live presently And that was my main goal, and thankfully I did it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, you know, that getting in touch with yourself and that, you know, shining the light on that dark side, you know, or that pain within. I mean, it's it seems to be a critical aspect of the healing process. Now, with this the hashtag MeToo movement, you know, going on right now, do you feel that it will have an effect on the situations in the military, you know, or is this more of a, do you feel that it's kind of helping us move in the right direction, you know, and being able to raise awareness?
Boy, I can only hope. I truly hope. And I think, first of all, just to acknowledge the survivors who have come forward. They are brave. They are courageous. It is beyond belief to make the decision to take the steps to heal your life and to take responsibility for your life and how you feel and to pursue that empowerment that you so, so deserve. So I feel you and I surround you with love, just to first acknowledge those that have come forward. And to your point, I really believe we are in the midst of this pivotal time of change right now within this country. And with some resistance, for sure, we finally have made space to have this conversation. And it's incredible. And my heart screams that I hope we do it thoughtfully, mindfully, contributing to this discourse with our hearts open and our heads on straight to be able to push and pull against the societal norms that we're doing right now and delve in to what is really at stake, to explore deep enough sort of in our psyche as a nation and world to create a real everlasting shift and change. And my gut feeling is that the military cannot help but be moved by the greater movement. And I just hope that we can continue to the point of seeing real change.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and it seems to have set up a kind of a zeitgeist, a bigger space for the discussion to happen. You know, before it would be hard to link, you know, various kinds of experiences or, you know, the happenings, you know, in so many different areas of life, you know, be it Hollywood, the military, you know, the just everyday kind of experiences. Now it seems like there is a space created that, you know, you simply say, you know, me too, you know, and boom, you know, people are in that space, that headspace, you know, being able to recognize the issue and then recognize, you know, what isn't working and what could work better. And so, I mean, to me, it seems like it, you know, that it's, you know, forever, you know, once you create that big, you know, headspace for people to be able to, you know, the consciousness to kind of tune into, that it's kind of hard to turn back from that.
From your lips. I totally agree with you. And we have this beautiful opportunity, right, with this awakening that our country is doing, with this enlightening that we are experiencing right now, this beautiful opportunity of connection, of working together to see real change and progress, and to really experience an aspect of human nature and humanness and humanity that is the essence of why we're here. So from your lips.
Absolutely. So now with, you know, like the Kavanaugh kind of case going on, the recent sentencing of Cosby, one of the things that I wondered about is the survivors of abuse experiences, how they react to it being kind of in front of their faces again. So, you know, is it, do you relive the experience? And I guess it would probably be depending on your healing path. But, I mean, generally speaking, whenever you see something similar kind of played out before you, what feelings emerge?
I think you're so right with what you said in terms of it completely depends on each person and where they are along their healing path. I know for myself, it is imperative that first and foremost, I am required to check in with myself daily, hourly. And I encourage everybody to do that anyway. How do I feel? How is this landing? Where am I? Getting a sort of a GPS coordinate for where I am and how I feel emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally. And to really reiterate that it is our opportunity with every difficulty that we have, with every struggle that we can face in our human lives, we absolutely have a choice whether to take responsibility for ourselves and our emotions and to really do whatever we can to take care of ourselves on every level, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, to do the work that it takes to address the original incidents of trauma and neglect and loss or grief that shape us so that when something comes up and we are faced with it again, like the news of Cosby, like the news of Kavanaugh, like everything that's going on right now, we're not thrown back into trauma, but rather we can truly offer ourselves in a helping capacity to hold that vibration of knowing the well-being that far outweighs the darkness of our world. And for me, after I check in with myself, that's most important. And then it's a matter of seeing how I best can contribute. Where do my superpowers lie and how can I be of most service and contribution to this world and experience and discourse? How can I help?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you know, that was the one thing that just, you know, as I was watching things unfold, you know, that it's, it was my hope, you know, that survivors don't re-experience, you know, the pain, but maybe there is just an awareness that there is some kind of validity or, you know, to their, you know, their experience, or recognition of, you know, that it occurs and, you know, people need to be held accountable, you know, for that. And now with the, you know, sentencing of Cosby just recently, I mean, when I saw that, it was, to me, it was, I mean, it seemed minimal, you know, compared to the number of women who, you know, experienced, you know, abuse at his hands, you know. But, you know, I don't, you know, I can't really, you know, as far as judgment is concerned, to me it just seemed out of whack for the amount of pain caused, you know. But
Robert?
Uh-huh.
You know what? It's a really good point, and it speaks so beautifully to the fact that though it may be cathartic and it may feel good to go through that process of bringing somebody to justice, and I quote unquote, and I speak from having experience in that while at the academy, it is where the catharsis truly comes in, is you standing up and finding your voice and taking those steps to really heal yourself. And the sentencing, to rely on something external like the sentencing in order to feel good or better about the attack that you survived is never going to be enough. It's never going to be enough because the horrific nature of whatever you have survived as a survivor is going to far outweigh any sentencing or external mandate or judgment that somebody can throw upon your attacker. If you rely on that, anything external, that goes for anything external, it's not going to be as satisfying as you ultimately think it's going to be. But what is truly satisfying and earth-shifting and ground-shifting and life-altering is you finding the empowerment and the desire to really change your life and work through that pain and find your value and find your love for yourself and learn how to take care of yourself and set your boundaries and do all of those things that we would do to our children or our loved one, all of those things that we sometimes ignore for ourselves. That's where the real satisfaction and change comes from. So thankfully for Cosby's accusers, they were able to find some quote-unquote external justice. But I assure you, the fact that they spoke up, that they found their truth, that they started the journey to really change their life and reverse that victimhood, that's where the real satisfaction comes.
Yeah, well, you know, I agree with you, and I'll be looking at things differently, you know, because it's in a sense, it's you fight that abuse of power by being empowered, and being empowered.
That's exactly right.
That makes perfect sense.
Beautifully said. Wow. Okay, in that space, from that space, real change can happen. From that empowered space, real conversation can happen and real progress can happen. And I wish that for everyone in their life, regardless of whether they have been sexually assaulted or have endured violence or abuse of some sort. Empowerment, that is where the real change lies.
Yeah. Well, gosh, we're down to the end of the show, Polo. So if there are women or men listening who are currently experiencing some kind of abusive treatment, what kind of words of advice or, you know, things might you want to say to them?
Most acutely, if you are in danger, get help. I included a list of really amazing resources in the back of Deep Dark Blue, in the back of my book, for you to get help if you are in an acute, dangerous situation. And secondly, I cannot express to you enough how deeply, how profoundly I know this to be true, having gone through it myself, but how incredibly worthy you are to be here, to be on this planet, to be in your own life and in the lives of those who care about you. It's the most important thing that we can do in this life experience is to find love for ourselves. And no one can take your joy. That is the most profound thing I've learned.
Wonderful. Well, Polo, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. It's really enlightening and certainly, again, very topical. And I'm sure that, you know, just your words and your experiences will help those who have listened in. So, again, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate it, truly.
Great. It's been my pleasure. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Polo Tate, and we've been talking about her experience and her new book, Deep Dark Blue, A Memoir of Survival. Again, her book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link in the show page description to her book there, as well as you can find out more about Polo by visiting her website, which is polotate.com, and that's polotate.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website as well in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show, and until we meet again...
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's B-I-T-E radio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.